Welcome to the M&A's Inc. weekly podcast for acquisition entrepreneurs, holdco builders in Europe, the UK and beyond. Today, I am delighted to be joined by Amit Rai, who is CEO and one of the founders of Astra Holdings, a UK-based private holding company. We also have Michele and Andrea, who are from Michele is a CEO and Andrea is the business development director from Lindberg SPA, a publicly listed company on the EGM in Milan. Gentlemen, shall we start with our conversation about the differences between public and private activities in building a holdco with a little bit of an introduction about yourselves? Amit, you're...
I can go first. Unfortunately or fortunately, we are not public yet. We are a pretty young company. We started about a year ago. So what is Astra? Astra is a serial acquirer of profitable industrial British companies. We started a year ago. We have bought two businesses. We are at about sort of 50 people, I would say 14 million revenue in the last 2 years. Our aim is to buy another 30, 40 businesses over the next 6 to 7 years, but we want to run them in a decentralized manner. So we look up to the Nordics and the Nordic serial acquirer model and want to keep the model closer to that. Yeah.
Fabulous. Thank you, Amit. Michele.
Oh, thank you. I am Michele. I am the co-founder and CEO of Lindberg SPA in Italy. We founded the company in 2006. So next year, we have 20 years old. And we make historically logistics business since 2006 and waste management. And since 2 years, we start to be serial acquirer in HVAC sector in Italy. And since 2 years, we bought around 11 company, and the total turnover of the group this year, I think 32 million with 4-5 million of EBITDA, and we quoted the company in 2021, so we are 3 years and a half quote in stock exchange in Milan. So in 1 minute, 20 years of history.
Indeed, and yes, we'll try and get a bit deeper into that in a moment. Andrea, anything to add on that front?
No, I only think as we've been working with Michele since 2008, so my, I can say, first working experience. So it's a good journey. So we have a good story to tell to our branch here.
Yeah, absolutely. Michele, do you have a mic? Yes, good. Okay. So I'll start with a question about velocity. How does one manage to do multiple acquisitions in a short space of time with a small team to execute that M&A? You guys have managed to do 11 deals in 18 months. Amit, you did 2 deals in very quick succession there, I think within subsequent quarters,
yes,
which was incredible. What's the secret to that kind of success? Who would like to go first?
No secret. We bought a small company. Okay. The smallest is 500,000 turnover. The biggest is 4 million turnover. And we know very well, we have the capability inside the company to read the balance sheet, to speak about numbers, to speak about people. And we have some consultants that he work with us about numbers, and we help, they help us to do the deal. So the company that we acquire are very, very simple. They have turnover in HVAC. Okay, we are very, very vertical. Okay, we know the market, and they have turnover and 2-3 big amount of cost is labor cost, is spare parts cost, and we know very well where we have to see inside the balance sheet, and we speak directly with the seller. This is the point. So we prefer to speak directly with the seller.
Do you mean non-brokered deals then?
Yeah.
Do you mean deals that are not sourced through a broker or through an intermediary?
No. No. We speak always with the seller, because usually the seller stay in the company for 1 year, 2 years, okay. And this is the point. So we have to find the right solution, not only to close the deal, but to find the right solution for the after the deal.
Mm.
just to manage the company, how we can, the transition time, the implementation of our project. So it's not only a financial deal, but is an operational
deal. Then transitional deal.
Absolutely.
I'd like to get into the deal structure that enables that in a little while, if we can. So we'll put a pin in that and come back to how you keep those sellers involved as operators to help that process of a smooth transition and integration. Amit, your quick deals in succession, very small nuclear team that pulled these off. How's it done here? And what were the challenges in doing so?
So we are trying to build a serial acquirer engine that can get to the point where we can acquire 6 to 8 companies every year. So what we are doing is we're looking at it almost like a manufacturing plant and saying, what are the bottlenecks in the process and how can we make this a repeatable process? It's still early days, so we're still learning, and the bottleneck sort of moves from places to places. I would say the first part is still the most up in the air process, which is origination. You know, we are talking to tons of brokers, we are looking at lots of platforms, we're looking at both on market and off market deals. So at that point, it's really about growing the funnel as much as possible. It still feels a bit more like an art than science. You know, things, interesting things pop out of it. If I had to say what is the secret to success in that first bit, for now, I would say luck. There is no more than that, which of course is not a repeatable thing, but we want to get to the point where it's repeatable. Next is really around the due diligence and closure of the company. There we have built a fantastic set of partners. You know, we do commercial due diligence ourselves. Both me and my founder, we have co-founder, have consulting background, so we are very comfortable in doing CDDs. But for FDD and LDD, we have found amazing partners, and that really gives us the scale. And these lawyers can also help us close the deal. I think the other variability for us still comes in the very end when you're closing, because we fund our deals with a combination of equity and debt. Thankfully, equity we have at a holdco level, so we can deploy it without having to go back to our board. I mean, we do go back to our board, but we at least don't have to go back to our investors to seek permission. So that process is really quick. The debt bit is still not that great because we are raising debt on a deal-by-deal basis, right? So I think that's our whole process. There's still a bit of places where we can become much faster in increasing the velocity.
And I'm interested from both of you as to whether velocity is aided through integration or separation, whether buying them and keeping them, carrying on doing their own thing until you fully understand them and can make some changes is a great idea, whether that helps successive deals to happen faster when you're not in the weeds with a particular business, or whether actually getting through the pain barrier, ripping the plaster off and ripping off the Band-Aid and going through that transition quickly is more recommended. Would you like to explain a bit about your post-deal integration or separation activity?
So our post-deal integration is not so easy because, as Michele stated, our aim is to implement our industrial plan. So basically to do what we already do with our customer in the networks management disaster. So basically implementing services and processes to increase the productivity and the profitability of those companies. So we ask the company we acquire not to change, but to evolve. And sometimes changes may scare people. This year, for the first time, we are meeting all the companies we acquired next Monday, 120 people. We are putting them in a single room saying, okay, guys, we want to go there. We want to develop our logistics model. We want to close the peripheral warehouse. We want to apply our logistics distribution model. We want to develop B2B rather than B2C. We want to bring, as a group, a corporate customer. And we need your help. So we don't want to change your local routes because you have the contact with the final customer. So this is important. That's something that must be kept. But on the other hand, with our help, because we are not HVAC people, we are not technical people in this industry. But we saw huge field service companies doing many improvements in their processes. So we know exactly what needs to be done in the next 3-4 years to become the first national player in installation and maintenance of HVAC. Of course, this is not helping the velocity of the integration as soon as we don't have committed people and a sort of integration team inside the group.
Yeah.
And it's something that we are
starting to build in these weeks.
It's a moment of maturity, though, for an acquisitive company, isn't it? Where you actually end up not just with a corp dev team, but with a post-deal integration team. That's, you know, it's a luxury to have at the beginning, because these are overheads that you can't necessarily carry. You can't support these costs, but actually becomes a necessity once you've got to a velocity. Amit, could you speak to your plans there?
Yeah. So we thought about how to increase velocity in post-merger integration, and our answer was don't do it. So it's sort of a conscious decision. With serial acquirers, you can go the decentralized route or you can go the roll-up route, which is what, you know, you guys are doing. We decided not to go down that route and sort of stick with the decentralized model, which is, again, what the Nordic serial acquirers do or people like Constellation do. That said, we do try and align on the financial side. That's one thing that we push very hard, is to make sure that there is consistent reporting, there's consistent way of reporting KPIs, and there's a cadence. That tends to be, or well, at least till now, has tended to be a relatively easy task to do, because during the DD process itself, we are able to establish those KPIs, and sort of rolling them out post-acquisition has been easy. So for now, we're not worrying too much about it. The other thing which we're beginning to see, of course, is given we have acquired two companies, we are finding lots of interesting companies in those spaces that should improve our DD space. And so we should be able to close deals much faster. But post-closure, we don't intend to integrate this company.
Okay, so even if they're in the same space, you just buy, not even as a tuck-in to a platform, you would just buy them and have more.
We might do a few bolt-on, but I think this is where you have to be almost careful from day one and choose a lane and stick to the lane. Like one of our value propositions to a seller is to say, we will leave you alone. Right, we will not try and like change the ways of working. You know, it's all about legacy. It's all about longevity. And we have found in few cases where we have started discussing even bolt-on acquisitions, you're basically going back on your internal promise, and you can't have an inconsistent model. So we're still trying to figure it out. What we might end up doing is buying two companies who are in the same space, but are not competing head-on. So they can learn from each other and they can collaborate. But, you know, we don't want to get into a point where they're competing head-on, because that's when you would need to bring them together. And that's not what we want to do.
What the Nordics do very well is that autonomy, that independent operation of the businesses, but with some shared processes and shared learnings, but also kind of, they call it clustering. Yeah, and putting these businesses together into a managed cluster where they can learn from each other, collaborate with each other, but they're not changing anything that's going to potentially be to the detriment of the customer by trying to shoehorn one business into the other. So it's a really inspired way of doing the post-merger kind of value creation rather than value destruction, which can often come when we try and put, you know, smash companies into one. Let's talk about the capital structuring, the deal. So we'll talk in a minute about capital coming in, because you mentioned about having equity finance, which is great. And obviously you guys are tapping the capital markets for your acquisition capital. But on the deal structuring side, you touched earlier, Michele, about needing your sellers to stick around for a while. How does that, what kind of shape do your acquisitions take in terms of rollover equity, or, you know, options in the holdco, or deferred consideration, earnout, conditionality? What do you do to keep those sellers focused and keep them involved?
For the moment, fortunately, in Italy, we have more seller than buyer. So I think that we are the first in Italy that we move in the sector. So we can contract with the seller with a good condition, and they usually accept a postponement of payment. Usually we pay 50% of the total price at the closing, and then 2-3 years of postponement. Not on out for the moment. It's not on
no
out.
Condition.
Not on out. Okay. Not on out. Yeah. Without conditions. Without we a guarantee of the Lindbergh, okay, on the payment. And usually we ask that they stay inside the company at least 6 months or 1 year.
Okay.
Okay. This is the end. Usually we find inside the company cash. And usually that company, they don't have debt inside. Mm-hmm. So we are thinking about to use much more the financial leverage just to put the debt inside the company that we bought, that we buy.
And you then release the cash on closing that's on the balance sheet to the sellers if you're...
Yeah.
Do they take some of the surplus cash with them?
Yeah.
Yes? Okay.
Yeah.
But they're incentivized to stick around for a period, because half of the consideration is over 3 years.
Yes, but we we contract with the seller just a period for to allow us to implement and to find new people and new person that take the management of the company. Sure. So we don't need as an earnout to incentivize the seller to stay and to reach the result at the end of 2-3 years. It's not at the moment all the deal that we made don't is not earnout.
Yeah, good, very fair. And you don't get any resistance to 50% deferred consideration?
I was about to say that 50% day one payment. You know, I want to switch seats with you.
Yeah, exactly. I take it you're not then achieving such lofty heights of half the...
No, it's an interesting conversation we always have. So, the sort of deals we're doing, we want the management team to stay back. The management team may or may not be the same as seller. So if it's a 70-year-old who's selling, but there's some other management team who's staying back, that's totally fine. Almost every conversation goes like this. We think this company is just about to take off. It's going to do amazingly well next year, the year after, the year after, the year after.
Jams borrowed.
Yeah, it's just like, it's just going to be brilliant. You're going to be so lucky. We said, okay, you know what? As a result, we're willing to pay you more, but why don't we structure some of the payments linked to those amazing performance that is going to hit next year? And then everybody says, no, I want 100% of cash today, right? And then you start negotiating from that point onwards. There's nothing typical, but typically I would say our deal is 20% seller deferred, 40% equity, 40% debt. With seller deferred, we also don't do any sort of earnouts. It's a fixed amount. As long as the revenue is within a band, we will pay that out. But that money would definitely go back to them.
Great. Well, that's very refreshing to hear those deal structures, gentlemen. Thank you for sharing that. So on the capital coming into the acquisitions then that you're having to raise in order to execute these, could you speak to how being a public company has made that possible or made that easier or made that more difficult?
I think easier because when we start, we raise around 4 million, 3.54 million. Okay, in the 21, and that, and after we have again 2.7 million at the end of last year because we have the warrant and all the warrant were executed. So we gain, and I think there's a big opportunity to raise capital, and many funds know us. So I think that for now is a big opportunity. We use only in the IPO. In 3 years in the IPO for Warren.
And then one placement.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
That's great. And what does that bring by way of obligation on you? Like in raising that money publicly, beyond the reporting requirements, because the wheel has to keep turning, right? So what we see about the Nordic acquirers is they're almost obligated every year to do more deals. Otherwise, you see it damage the price to earnings ratio or the market cap kind of suffers a bit as a consequence. So I wonder if, are you under now this kind of like, treadmill, if you will, of must keep acquiring in order to keep the public market satisfied?
Yes, but it's not for public market. It's for us that we make our business. So I think that if we are able to speak with the investor, the public investor, not only the big funds but the retail too, or the small family office that you have inside our investor base, I think that and they agree with our strategy. I think that the interest of the shareholders is the same interest that we have. We are shareholders. Mm. So I think that we are very, very clear in our communication to the market. I put inside the financial statement all the information that I see need to the investor to choose or not to stay in the company or to invest more or to invest in the company. No problem. Because, we have the strategy. Okay, you are an investor. If you want and share the strategy, okay, invest. But if you don't want, no problem. I can go through other investor. No, so it's very important for me to be public and to speak a lot with investor and to be very, very, very clear in the representation of the company.
It's obviously serving you well though, because 26% EBITDA growth in the last period and 19% revenue growth. I think is that what you've reported in 24? that's, you know, I'm sure your investors are very happy with that outcome.
Yes, but yes, we start in the IPO in 2021. We made 9 million. And this year, I think more than 30 million. So with the market cap is 30, 36, 35.
Beautiful. Wonderful.
Yes. And for us is I repeat that for us is a sort of gasoline.
Yeah.
Energy. So we want to do, but not just to do, but is our life. So for us is very important to find a right motivation to do our job. We can make a mistake. We can do better, but that's very important. Our motivation.
At which point does it become self-sustaining? You've done two placements, an IPO and a placement for the warrant. At which point do you find that the cash that's just generated by the business units is enough to fund the next acquisition and keep that cadence going?
Yes, this is the goal. This is the goal to find a right strategy to self-financing the growth without any additional capital.
Are you under pressure to achieve that goal by any particular year, or?
I think 2-3 years.
Great. Okay. And so Amit, by contrast, raising money as a private company,
yeah,
particularly at the beginning of the journey with a pitch.
Yes.
Look, I mean, the end goal, the nirvana for a serial acquirer is hitting that inflection point where the flywheel effect kicks in.
Yeah.
You never need to raise any more money and life, the compounding engine takes over and just money falls from the roof. Right? That's where we're all trying to get to. Question is, how long does it take? But also, what is the size of the engine you're trying to build? Right? So we have had tons of conversation, right, where people want you to, actually the early stage investors want you to build a small engine. You know, we've had cases where people said, just go buy one company or two company, wait for 7 years, then buy another two, wait for another 7 years, and your grandchildren will be really rich, right? You know, so that is one thing you have to decide is, what is the size of the engine, how fast you want to get to, and, you know, where will you get capital from? Private money is painful. You know, what I've heard is, and then you guys are the experts in this, in some way, if you can get public money, it is a lower cost of capital, but it does come with all kinds of sort of reporting issues. The other thing, which we also struggle with a little bit, is this is essentially a long-term hold model. And when you contrast that with public equities, they tend to look at this thing on a quarterly basis. And then that creates a lot of pressure for these companies who are doing long-term hold to sort of try and take actions that are more short-term in nature, right? And we were in Stockholm. I know you guys were there as well. And you talked to a bunch of people. For example, there are Finnish serial acquirers who had a very hard time because of their exposure to Russia. Longer term, I think they will be totally fine. But shorter term, because of those things, they've taken a lot of beating. So we're still early stage. At some point, you know, we will think about listing. That said, we haven't quite answered the question, why do you need a listing? Is it to give liquidity to early stage investors? Is it to continue to raise new cash, or just purely for emotional reasons? And at least I find a lot of Nordics do it just for the heck of it. I mean, if you look at Roku, which IPO'd at about 3 billion this year, they didn't really need any cash. So any cash raised from the public equity has actually gone back to early stage investors.
Right? Yes, exactly. Already.
Yeah. So it's like, why did you need to do an IPO?
Well,
because I think Fredrik Karlsson wants to compete with the other other serial acquirers.
Yeah.
But that's a good enough reason.
Yeah, I think
I think that the secret is to find, as I told before, the investor with a
patient capital on the public market.
The public.
Yes. Yeah, that's the unicorn, isn't it?
Yes.
Great. Let's talk about some of these obligations. I mean, you guys index a lot on ESG, on the circular economy, on energy efficiency, and obviously you're acquiring in HVAC, which, you know, we're going to need more of it. Global warming. And it's going to use more energy. What does that, as a public company, what does that do for your, what kind of metrics are you finding you're happy to hit alongside the financial ones in an ESG context for the markets to be happy that you're a, you know, ethical investment?
No, this is because of some of the energy.
No, basically, our aim is to bring improvements in the environmental sustainability for our customer. This is the main aim of our circular economy business union. So basically, we put in place some specific projects Above all, in the luxury industry, you know, it's public. We work for LVMH Group in Italy. We are the main partner, helping them in managing all the unsold goods and products. And they have really huge quantities. Basically, helping them in not just recycling material, but trying to produce recycled material using the waste we used to collect all over Italy in many industry, cosmetics, leather industry, leather goods, and so on. And in this case, of course, logistics and waste management is just a little part. Then we have all the reporting issue, the IT integration with all the supply chain, the periodical reporting to the final customer. So our work in ESG is made in this sense. Of course, we are also a logistics company, so we have our own vans running over Italy every night. We have our sustainability report we release annually. So in this case, and as you stated correctly, also HVAC needs to be driven by efficiency. In this case, also in Italy, we have lots of fiscal bonuses driven by the government, helping people to change all the machineries in order to get new machine with better environmental performances. I can say that this can be also a risk, because if the bonus ends, then some company may lose quite a lot of turnover. In this case, we don't see this kind of impact in the companies we acquire, but we saw some target that were very impacted in this sense.
I see. Yeah. Is there any such obligation on a private business, Amit, or is it a personal choice?
It's a personal choice. We know what are the kind of companies we want to buy. But outside of that, this is not something we're actively managing. That said, we sort of end up indirectly managing it, because both our companies do go after large contracts with other companies and with the government, and you just have to be sensible to win those contracts.
Mm. So if there is one nugget of wisdom that you'd like our assembled audience to leave with, if they're debating a path that takes them to become a public company, or whether they should explore, or whether what they need to navigate as a private company first, with multiple acquisitions, perhaps each of you could just spend 30 seconds imparting, you know, one nugget of wisdom that these folks might find useful. Andrea?
I have one. As soon as you get public, talk to investor. It's your obligation. It's a job in a job. It takes effort, but it's the best part of my job, to travel, to meet many times the same people. It was they still are investor.
Yeah, proper. Investor relations is a full time job.
they trust you. So in some cases we see companies that they get public, they raise money from the IPO, and then they disappear.
Mm.
And this reflects also the stock price, because they don't grow, even if they are good companies with good economical performance. So if you're public, talk to investors. You have to do it.
Great lesson.
That's a great lesson. I'll just echo and extend it. Doesn't matter whether you're public or private. Talk to your investors. Existing and potential.
Yeah.
It's a full-time job, for sure.
Anything operationally, Michele, from a public company perspective that people might want to be aware of? Or from a perspective of somebody with such a velocity of acquisitions, is there something that perhaps if you reflect on the journey that maybe you wish you'd known at the beginning of it?
No, I think I'm very happy to be public. Very happy to be public, and I think that for us is a good way for the old shareholder or for the main shareholder inside the company. This is another point for me is very important, because we found the company. Okay, we at the very beginning 50-50 with the current president of the company and Andrea with the minority shares. Okay, and to be public. Each shareholder can do with share what he wants. Before it's impossible to do that because we are all in the same company. So all we find found inside the company, but we want to maintain the full control of the company. We don't want found inside our board. We want to decide by ourselves. So it's very, and the public allow to do that.
Yeah.
So it's very important. If Andrea tomorrow want to be 3% and not 4% can go to the market. And
quite interesting how much is actually delegated to the board more in a public market setting as a public company. The boards get more control over running the business than often.
Yes, but is the board actually is nominated by us. So we are, yes, we are majority in the board there. We have, okay, inside we are an independent, we are selling people in the board, but in the board, but all is very known by us. And I didn't see a big difference between private as
because you are the discipline of involving your shareholders and communicating with your shareholders and running a private company like it was a public company, I imagine. So, yeah, great. Really useful stuff. Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thanks a lot.
We've got time for a few questions from the floor. Yes, sir? You had your powder first.
Thank you. That's very interesting. You mentioned that you're modeling Casper Abbey, all the Nordic serial partners, but they differ quite a bit and acquisitions are involved. Then how they set incentives, because the centralization is a spectrum, but they do set incentives, the seven boards, the CCDs, and so forth. And Frederick Kyle said then, you're going to do it. It's quite differently. Or extremely successful. So, one question, one sub question. What have you picked from the different Nordic models? Is there only one that you think is superior, or are you picking and choosing the different ones? And the second one is particularly in regards to how you set a subsidiaries and the operational oversight. Do you plan to standardize this before you pick up the pace of M&A? Because we see, I would name let's say Tekion, because struggling with this, we're working rather quickly without standardizing M&A or the operational oversight.
Yeah, just going to restate the question for the purpose of the mic, because I won't have picked up that gentleman's question. But I guess it's a two-part question. Are you picking particular parts of Nordic models to execute your deals, incentivize your teams, etc., or are you emulating one in specifically? Secondly, are you getting your M&A kind of process standardized before you scale?
Yeah.
Not only M&A, the
operational.
Yeah.
So on the first one, I wish I could replicate Rocco, but I can't because I'm not Frederick Carlson, right? He can go buy 30 unconnected assets in 6 years and list at, 30x multiple or whatever he has done for 3 billion. So I wish I could replicate him, but I can't, right? Because prior to that, he had 20 years of senior leadership position, and I don't have that. In terms of are we following one or picking from others, I think we like the broader thesis of decentralization, right? How you actually implement is something we're learning by ourselves, because UK market is very different from the Swedish market. The sort of businesses we are buying, they require very sort of bespoke answers, right? So to that extent, the philosophy is something we're following. But the actual implementation of the philosophy is very sort of Astra specific, right? Bit of a woolly answer, but that is what it is. Then the second thing is in terms of, operational controls, like we have a very clear idea of how we want these companies to run, right? Financial KPIs are very important. We sit down and we write after acquisitions, set a strategy. Based on the strategy, we come down with a one-year plan, a three-year plan, a five-year plan. For a one-year plan, we have initiatives. For initiatives, we have a reporting structure. To the extent that the management team just executes on it and follows it within a band, we don't have to do too much. Of course, if they start to deviate from them, then we have to go in and sort of, bring them back in line. But the whole magic of decentralized serial acquirer model is you find amazing companies and amazing people, and fingers crossed, you can leave them alone to do what they need to do. Huh? So outside of finance, we don't try and tell them how to do their job, but we do put those guardrails to ensure their tracking.
Well said. Gentlemen, have you, from that perspective, standardized procedures both around the deal making and the post deal kind of operational piece? Have you you've got things as a mold, as a model now that you just keep turning out every time you do these deals?
Yes, the today we need, as Michele said before, to industrialize the acquisition process on one side, and also the onboarding process, which in our case is the most difficult.
Yeah, most times which you
are.
Okay, great. Another question, Yushan?
Yeah, first, thank you for the talk. As I mentioned before, I'm a shareholder at Litberg, so it's great to see you. Also great to follow this mantra a little bit of this notion that you get the shareholders you deserve, so you do us wise for the business, and I personally don't care about the next quarter or anything. That's our chance for short term.
Thank you.
Some of the smaller deals you do, I feel like at that size, talent becomes almost more of a problem than the capital. And how do you deal with talent if normally the owner, you said, walks after 6 months? How do you find replacement? How do you make sure it works well? It's fully incentivized, and the owner, these swappers are so owner dependent. Who works 80 hours and you couldn't replacement, maybe who doesn't know so much, doesn't work as hard to make sure it's still working well.
Talent being more important than capital in these deals of this size. Well, that was a very insightful point, sir. Thank you for that.
Yes.
Your response?
But I think that in all business is always a matter of people, because the company that we bought, that we buy, is inside there we will find people, so it's very important to keep a connection with the people, and not only with the owner and with the seller, but with all the people that we find inside the company. This is the point. If we, with our project, give the opportunities to the people, not only the seller, that the seller is the seller, but the other people, all the technician inside, all the back office people inside, and we involve in our project, this is the key point, because we have all people, 10 people, 15 people, 20 people that follow us and build up with us our industrial project. And in 2 years, 1 year and a half, we didn't lose any people. So it's been that our project is very appreciated inside, and it's true that with our project and with our job inside, we create opportunities for all the people. This is the point. A very, very big involvement of the people. Okay, we don't want to go there and say, okay, from tomorrow you have to do that, you have to do that, you have to change that. No.
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
It's a marathon, not a sprint. One of the things the Nordics have done very well is that talent spotting, that cultivation of the top 20% and the sort of next 20% to bring through that future leadership program. I mean, Indutrade over-index on that. It's fabulous. Like the amount of career development, learning and development, progression opportunities that they almost encourage every new company in the group to indulge.
And we found inside the company many, many young people very focused on the market, but before with the big boss, very, very, yes, this is the point.
Oppressed sometimes.
Oppressed, exactly. Exactly, oppressed.
If the first company where the original boss left, this year is running plus 30% to growth.
Yeah,
with the young people. And he's also good because... He made a sort of operational complete organization of the maintenance activity, and we will ask him to take this best practice to be extended to all the other companies.
Yeah, and I bet the loyalty you get from that member of staff will be quite tangible as a consequence of that trust you placed in him. Well, yeah, great.
Exactly.
We've got time for one more question. Any body with 2X chromosomes that would typically want? No. Okay, we'll take another one then. You said, did you have them or? Yes, okay.
I just want to pick up all the issue about first acquisition integration part. So, take what you said. Well, you decide what level of decentralization that you okay to decide the, you know, but if you decide community decentralization, then you are really value of the name, right? You're not capturable synergies.
Common misconception. you would assume that economies of scale are beautiful. And integration is where you get the synergies and you decost the operation. Yeah, Amit, thoughts?
Yeah, so we get asked this question all the time. It's a question of business model and where do you want to spend your time? So if I had bought a 100 million EV business, would I leave them by themselves and go and try and buy the next 100 million? Probably not. I mean, also it depends on how much cash I have. But, you know, if on the other hand, I want to buy, you know, 21 million EBITDA companies, I cannot go into the weeds and run them for them. Right. And the question always has to be when you're going and buying these businesses, and it's a bit like the same advice people give to you in a relationship, you know, when you find your better half, do you like them for who they are or who they will be once you start interfering? Right. So we buy businesses who we like for who they are. You know, yes, they can always improve. And one of the things that we do spend time on is talking to the management team to get a sense that are they open to suggestions. But we don't want to go in there knowing nothing about the industry, nothing about the ways of working, to start telling them how to run their lives. Right? We just don't want to do that.
Same principle in Lindbergh, or slightly
different? It's basically the same approach. We also have to consider that we don't have any HVAC background.
Yeah.
But we can help them in applying new processes, helping them to develop the commercial parts to bring them a huge national corporate tomorrow. But
yeah, they're the subject matter, actually.
Yeah. By the way, just to add to one more thing as well, right? I mean, if you go look at business school texts, they will always say M&A destroys value. 100%, right? If you go look up HBR, there will be articles after articles, data after data saying M&A destroys value. And it is precisely because the acquiring company tries to add value on the company by which they end up destroying value. And then as a result, the aha of all that exercise is you shouldn't do M&A, right? And if you enter this world with that sort of thought process, then this is the wrong place to be. And, you know, these are serial acquirers. And yes, you know, Nordics are there. You know, these guys are there. They're a bunch of serial acquirers who've made this model work. It's precisely because they know where to add value, but equally where not to try and add value and just step back and let it run. So finding that balance is very important.
Find the business where value can be added without having to force the value add.
Yeah.
Great point to end on, folks. I think that was an amazing question. Thank you very much. A really interesting panel discussion. Thank you to Michele Corradi, Andrea Allegrini, and to Amit Rai. Thank you, everybody, for participating. Quick round of applause for our participants.
Yes, sir.